On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language. The Double X Gabfest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. The Double X Gabfest is brought to you by ShoeDazzle.com, where every item is only $39.95. Save $8 on your first order when you go to ShoeDazzle.com and enter the promo code XX.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, May 17th, the bare-chested edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX here in the Washington, D.C. studio, and I'm joined in New York today by Libby Copeland, who is a regular writer for XX. Hi, Libby.
Hi there.
And who is also a XX podcast virgin, we might say. This is her first appearance on the XX podcast, so we're very excited to have her. And our regular Noreen Malone, who is a writer for New York Magazine's Intel blog. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
Today, we are going to talk about the latest fight over attachment parenting, which was prompted by Time magazine's very provocative cover of an attractive woman breastfeeding an almost four-year-old child. Then we're going to talk about President Obama's old girlfriend letters, which came up in an excerpt of the upcoming Obama biography by David Marinus. It ran in Vanity Fair. And third, we're going to talk about whether a nine-year-old can be labeled a psychopath, which was a subject of a recent New York Times Sunday magazine story. So let's start with the attachment parenting. Before I even get into this topic, can I ask you guys a question? Do you find it irritating that Time magazine stories are not available online? Like, until actually someone sent me the PDF, yeah. The story itself, which was about Dr. Sears, and anybody who's had a child has come across Dr. William Sears and his various baby books, because there are millions of them. So surely you've read one of them, either the breastfeeding book or the baby book. It's essentially a profile of the father of modern attachment parenting. And it was actually quite good and really interesting. But I had digested the whole flap about attachment parenting before I read the actual story, because I had to wait for somebody to send it to me in PDF form.
I think the flap became a flap over breastfeeding and how you can breastfeed purely because people had only seen the cover. They had not actually read the piece inside.
There were like three sentences maybe about breastfeeding. It was such a minor point. And that the woman who had such a striking image and is now a celebrity had one like very anodyne quote.
Right. Yeah, she wasn't even a major character.
Yeah.
So the cover was this evil genius kind of cover, which showed an attractive woman. And I mention attractive because she was meant to convey urban sophisticate. She was a woman from L.A. She had, you know, highlights in her hair. She was wearing glittery shoes and sort of tight black clothes. You were not supposed to pick up the vibe of like Midwestern homeschooler at all.
Right.
You're supposed to pick up the vibe of like cool L.A. chick. And then the other evil genius thing they did was stand her toddler. I have a kid that age. Her kid is quite large, her son. I mean, my kid is pretty tall. He's three turning. He's about exactly the same age as the child in that cover photo. And her kid is giant. So he looks, you know, five and is, you know, 3 11/12 or whatever. And she's breastfeeding him on the cover. So you don't see her nipple, but you see sort of a hint of breast. And they're both looking kind of impassive, but also a little like, you know, fuck you, challenge me now, kind of.
Right. You got a problem with that.
Yeah, you got a problem with that.
Child.
Exactly. They both have the same expression of like being caught in the middle of a private world that they couldn't give a shit whether you peeked in on it or not. So the cover itself was like really very Tina Brown brilliant. In fact, I was really imagining Tina Brown, who also ran a story about the new hipness of homeschooling and attachment parenting, but was probably really annoyed that she hadn't thought of that awesome cover photo. One of the reasons I really like the accompanying story once I actually read it is that she does make a distinction between the hardcore world of attachment parenters who come up on radio shows all the time. You know, I sleep with my child until the child is 12. I breastfeed until the child is 15. Like the really hardcore attachment parenters. And then the ubiquitous influence of attachment parenting in the completely mainstream way of parenting. And I thought that's a really important distinction to make. So we're not talking about a fringe group versus as everybody else, but we're talking about kind of a broad influence. Libby, as a more recent parent than I am, what's your view on the influence of attachment parenting? Like, do you feel that when you were starting to parent, you know, the words of Dr. Sears saying, you know, you have to carry your baby around, you should sleep with your baby, you need to breastfeed for a long time, were they loud in your ear as you were parenting?
Absolutely. And I have to say that what struck me when I first saw this piece was, wait a minute, this book's only been out for 20 years.
Right.
Because it was so completely cemented into like the mortar of parenting education and parenting righteousness and what you must do, that I just assumed that he'd been around for much, much longer. Like, he obviously has been around for much longer, but that the baby book had been around for longer. And that basically this was just an accepted, you know, line of thinking about parenting. And, you know, the point that I thought also was interesting is that his interpretation of it and his intentions behind it versus what it's been interpreted as in the kind of the mainstream, the way that people actually carry it out, are two different things.
But did he strike you as more harsh than, like, more insistent?
No, less
harsh than you. Yeah. I don't know if I believe that, though.
Like, I mean, with the exception of the evangelical book that he, you know, apparently he wrote this one version that was like an evangelical version where he talks about women shouldn't be working outside the home because they might not realize it, but it does a lot of damage. With the exception of that sort of strain of thinking, which he says he's evolved from, he seemed to be much more kind of like casual about it. And the writer made the point that because there's so little kind of data and rules for the, you know, mothers to kind of glean from the books, that they just kind of go extreme and go all the way to avoid any of the gray areas. And that seems to be the problem with interpretations of him, is that he's so kind of wiggly that you wind up kind of taking him to an extreme just to avoid the guilt of possibly doing something wrong.
I think I disagree. I think the book is imbued with this, you know, ignore me at your own risk tone. In other words, even though he does not rely on data, as a lot of these modern parenting books about sleep, you know, data, which also strikes me as bogus, but they at least give that kind of cold scientific tone. But his tone has an underlying moralism to it, which is what irritates me. You know, there is a sort of you're doing it wrong and there is danger, which I think for a new mother who's pretty vulnerable, I don't appreciate. You know, looking back, I don't appreciate that. He doesn't say it doesn't matter what you eat or it doesn't matter, you know, how you carry the baby. He really does think that it matters, that the decision you make about, you know, leaving your child working, those things really have dire consequences for your child later in life.
You know, I guess I feel like two things about that. I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt for two reasons. One is that he was sort of writing in reaction to a style of parenting that he found deeply troubling, which was the style of parenting that he grew up with.
Which was negligent Catholic, slap you on the wrist, and he didn't have a father. That stuff I
right,
loved,
exactly.
By the way.
Like,
No, not that parenting. Ugh, I take that back.
The backstory
of William and Martha Sears, that they had both been raised in these pretty, you know, his father left when he was 1 month old, and her mother was schizophrenic,
her father died,
They were pretty neglected, it sounds like, as kids.
Right. And it also, I think it's not just that they were neglected, but the writer also talks about the way in which earlier parenting styles were often very cold and low on affection, you know. The other reason I say I'd be inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt, although I find some of his recommendations over the top, is because compared to the book What to Expect When You're Expecting and the kind of panic-inducing
moral undertone of that.
Yeah, that gives you, like, this is a walk in the park.
Right. And I have to say, it's not really about the books or the attachment parenting movement or William Sears. In some sense, the more interesting question to ask is, why are we ourselves at all vulnerable to any of this? Why is it that at a moment when, and the women working question is pretty central here, because why is it at this moment when, you know, women are working more and more and we're more ambitious and the culture depends on women's ambition, why is it that we are prone to such guilt and so vulnerable to this message? And why does it echo in our ears? Because, you know, what we really should do is say, like, okay, I'll carry the baby as much as I can, I'll breastfeed as long as I can. But, you know, the kind of heartbreak and moral panic, which, you know, wave after wave of my friends continue to have as they have small children about what it is they're failing to do for their children. That's the cultural question to ask. Like, why do we care? Why are we so beholden to this philosophy? Why does he have such a hold on us?
This is a little bit out of left field, but sort of the human instinct when you're confronted by something scary or uncertain is to, like, curl up in the fetal position and look for something nurturing, and or to be the nurturer, right? And so maybe it's some sort of reaction to things not being as they once were and sort of retreating to what is the cultural fetal position.
Meaning what? Like women are guilty? I mean, they just feel like they're becoming like, denatured in some ways, like the way we live yeah. now, the sort of fractured, overworked way is denatured. And then our body calls us back to some more primal reality and we just don't know how to deal with it. So we have these just kind of conflicts of ambivalence and guilt.
You perfectly laid out the argument I made in a very half-assed way. I'm not sure if you believe it, but I sort of feel as if that's the case.
Noreen, if you take your argument one step further, I mean, could you interpret this as part of the whole trend towards like quote-unquote authenticity, right?
And, mm-hmm. Well, that's the interesting part about Sears is that he wasn't the originator of this. He was the popularizer, right?
Like right.
He found some book about a woman who had studied, I forget what countries, but sort of more primitive tribes, quote unquote. And she came back talking about how they were so happy. I think it was in Latin America.
Yeah. And Venezuela, maybe.
Yeah. And how the kids were just so much happier and more balanced because they were close to their mothers all the time. And also, I don't have any children. So I, am still in sort of child mode. And I emailed my own mother who had kids before Sears wrote the book. And she was sort of like, this was around. Like, this is very much around. This was mm-hmm. sort of a modified version of this was her parenting style, actually, like not a very hard line, but her own mother was like, you hold your children too much. You
right.
like, and was like, she literally, I guess my mom wrote me a very sweet email this morning about this. I guess my grandmother said something like, they'll end up on the therapist's couch if you hold them too much, which is exactly what everyone's been saying on the Time cover, which I thought was funny.
This podcast is catching me at a really funny moment because I was really harsh about the Time magazine cover, as I almost always am when I talk about attachment
that
parenting
was great, though.
And breastfeeding.
That post was passed around so much, by the way, like from my friends who like are not at all breastfeeding or in that time of life at all. But you sort of called out the cover in a great way.
I think that the greatest public service I've ever done was write my case against breastfeeding story in the Atlantic magazine, because even though the initial response to it was so negative, I continue to get maybe 5 emails a month from women who are incredibly grateful because for one reason or another, they can't breastfeed and they feel so bad about it. And then someone gives them my article. So it's like the best thing I've done for women. But then it sort of locks me into this position of being this like, I hate attachment parenters, I hate breastfeeders, which is actually not my personal position. And a friend called me out on this recently, like, why are you so ironic and distant about this stuff when you don't actually parent that way? Like, you don't parent ironically, but you are so harsh and ironic in your parenting. So like, I told someone that I was chaperoning a field trip the other day and they were like, you chaperoning? And I was like, yeah, like I have 3 children. I go on field trips all the time. And somehow I realized that there is some disconnect between my self-presentation and what I actually do with my own children, and that I'm unresolved. Like, this harshness comes from a place of, I think, what you were talking about, Noreen, like some denatured, like I'm so busy, work, work, work. But then I have these children, I'm a totally different way with them. And I'm even 10 years into it, I'm sorry to say, am kind of unresolved about how to reconcile all those different strains of myself.
And not to make the nature argument too much, but attachment parenting, if you take it away from sort of the hard line thing, it really is sort of an instinct, right? Like
yeah.
you see
mm-hmm.
a child crying and you want to hold it, and that just seems primed to be broadly appealing to women because it's sort of, the like let your baby cry, time the times when you're going to let them cry is totally against like what you feel in the
yeah,
morning.
But now I'm going to be mean again. Like
okay,
possibly that's true, except the thing I really can't stand about attachment parenting, which I did write in that post, is that, and this is what Elizabeth Badinter in her book The Conflict says, is that it does necessitate of women a certain kind of emotional response that's correct to children. Are you kidding? Sometimes the baby cries and I want to throw them out the window. And the
right.
that response is, by the dictates of attachment parenting and Dr. Sears, incredibly unnatural.
Yes.
And, it's not unnatural. Like, you sit in the room with a crying baby, like when you're trying to relax or do anything, you want to throw them out the window. You do not always want to pick them up and love them and put them in between you and your husband. So it does box off all emotions, which I think are natural. Like, I would like to sleep with my husband without a crying baby
right.
in between us. As
boxes
wrong.
Off all emotions other than guilt.
Exactly. As wrong and unnatural.
Right.
And it's like,
right.
it's not wrong and unnatural. People hate their babies. People love their their babies. People are cold to that. You know, it's like parent. I mean, that is, in fact, the surprise about parenting. Like, it's not that you love your children. People understand that the surprise is that there's so much like anger and rage and like your house, as my friend once put it, is like suddenly you're turned into like an Italian mafia fan. Like, how did I become this person with like screaming and yelling in my, that's the surprise of parenting. So
yes, how it tests your personality.
Exactly.
The outer limits of your personality.
Right. I wrote about this in my breastfeeding piece, but the Sears baby breastfeeding book has a woman on the cover who's like beatific and happy. And like from the position of the sun, you can tell it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And like, I would just feel like squalid and horrible if I was sitting in my robe at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Like some days I might feel nice, but other days I would feel pretty like unhappy about that positioning.
Hannah, I'd like to say one more thing about that photo.
Yes.
The cover of Time, it's more than urban hip chick that they're trying to get across there. It is definitively a sexy photo.
Why do you say that?
There's something about the way she's dressed. It's the way she's standing. She's wearing very fitted clothes.
Right.
She's wearing basically like a kind of a spaghetti strap tank top that's kind of like pulled from her shoulder, like in a passive fashion, as if she's being seduced.
Right.
I don't know what it is, but I just think, you know, when you talk about evil genius, it has to be acknowledged that there's something downright sexy about the photo. And that's what, it's the age of the child
and the age
youth,
of the mom.
And the age of the mom, right? The youth and the sexiness of the mom. A lack of clothing and the fittedness of her clothing and the way she looks at the camera and the passivity and the sort of air of seduction about the whole thing that makes it part of the evil genius, right? That makes people go, oh my God, that child's going to be on a therapist couch because the mom is so damn sexy.
Right. Well, and the mom doesn't have the body of a woman who's been breastfeeding steadily for X number of years, which is, I think, also part of what you're calling the evil genius, is that, you know, then like women who don't have kids, not to mention women who do have kids, are like, wait, her body, like her exposed breast hair is like awfully pert, you know, like it's just
everything's pert.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the, you know, okay, this will really be the last thing. But when we were talking about Slate email, the first thing that came up was Game of Thrones. And everyone was like, wow, this is so Game of Thrones. Now, it's not really Game of Thrones because she's not like buxom with wild hair wearing gothic clothing, right? She looks
so
very...
I don't watch Game of Thrones. Can you explain?
Yeah, I just watch it over David's shoulder as I'm doing other things because I really can't bear that kind of television, but he really loves it. You know, it's sort of incesty and just kind of like, you know, these weird connections between people and sexual attractions of cousins. It has that vibe in Game of Thrones, you know. And somebody mentioned there actually is a scene, and maybe our listeners can point out my television idiocy here because I don't know the name of the scene, and the names were bantered back and forth on the email, and I was like, I can't keep up with this gothic nonsense. Like, I don't know what you guys are talking about, but a listener can help me out here. Like, that there is actually a scene like this in Game of Thrones of, like, a buxom, sexy woman, like, breastfeeding a baby who looks way too large. So that's what they mean, that kind of incest vibe that is runs right through those books. Okay, before we move on to our second topic, we have a brand new sponsor this week, which is incredibly exciting because it's kind of a ladyish sponsor as opposed to just a general kind of technological sponsor. And that is a site called Shoe Dazzle, which I actually just looked up. And Shoe Dazzle is part of this new trend on the internet of not just generalized shopping, but personal stylist kind of shopping. And so instead of just going to a website and seeing this large panel of gazillion shoes, they ask you a lot of questions and actually like to choose between shoes. And so they're trying to perfect kind of who are you and create a personal showroom for you and then present you with those shoes, which they do monthly. And every item is only $39.95. So no matter what you order, it's $39.95. And if you sign up, you save 20% off your first item when you click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner and enter double X. So I tried this. It's pretty simple. There's just a little microphone there. You enter the name Doublex, not the two X's, but double X on shoedazzle.com. And I urge our listeners to even just go on there and take the survey because it's pretty funny. My kids like to do these surveys, or my daughter and her friends, rather, on teen magazines. It's like, who would you go to prom with? You know, Justin Bieber or someone else. And it has you choose, like, are you the kind of girl who wears this? Or are you the kind of girl who looks like this? And that's what Shoe Dazzle goes. It's like, you go to a party, would you wear these heels or that heels? Like, what's your favorite heel preference? Like, whose closet do you like the most? And then, you know, it picks out like 50 shoes that you would like. So it's pretty cool. And we're glad to be a part of it.
Libby just wrote it down.
Shoedazzle.com. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I looked it up and I was looking up, like, it picked like half the shoes were pretty good for me, like wedges, and they had the right heel heights and everything. It was like somebody was listening to me. You know, that's the feeling I had after going on it. And it's not that expensive.
Frumpy flats. Exactly. I'll just look for those on there.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to our second topic. So Vanity Fair ran a long excerpt of David Marinus's new biography about Obama, which I can't wait to read because the excerpt itself was kind of amazing. And the excerpt focused mostly on old girlfriend letters. It was about his dark days in New York, which he talks about a little bit in Dreams of My Father, but which has always been a mystery hanging over Obama. Like, this was a period clearly when he was deciding which direction to go in, who he was going to be, how he was going to reconcile his racial history and his family with his future. And there was always a mystery girlfriend, which it turns out in Obama's biography was a composite girlfriend. And Marinus has kind of parsed out, like, which girlfriend is he talking about and in what phase. And then in kind of an amazing move, which I still haven't figured out what I think about, the girlfriend gave David Marinus her journal, and both two girlfriends, rather, the journal and the letters between them. So before we talk about the vision of boyfriend that emerges, can we talk a little bit about what you guys think about the girlfriend giving over the letters? Would you guys have given over the journal and letters? It's fine for Marinus to ask. I'm not questioning his journalistic ethics, but I am wondering, is something that intimate and private okay to give up to a journalist now that your ex is the president?
I don't think I would have, but I'm very glad that she did, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Like, I would be screaming mad if anyone ever did this to me.
Because why? Just because it's a violation of...
Oh, you're not a fully formed person when you're 20. You say idiotic things, particularly about relationships, and you are self-important and all these kinds of things. You know, if you look at the Robert Caro biography, right, of LBJ, like, he needed to look at, like, incredibly personal letters. Like, the president is pretty closed off right now, right? Everything from the moment going forward where he decided he was going to be someone, he was probably managing his image even in relationships with women. But at this point, he was just like a navel-gazing guy in Park Slope who, you know, was saying, or, you know, or on the Upper West Side, who was saying, like, everything that was on his mind, probably to a fault, definitely to a fault. But it makes for interesting reading. But yeah, I would never do that, personally.
I feel the same way. Like, it's not a cool thing to do. On the other hand, one learns so much about him. There's this line at Saturday, February 25th, from his girlfriend, Genevieve Cook, and she writes, "His warmth can be deceptive, though he speaks sweet words and can be open and trusting. There is also that coolness, and I begin to have an inkling of some things about him that could get to me." And you think, wow, like, there isn't a clear line between someone as boyfriend and someone as president. Like, you really do get to the bottom of his character. I mean, if we care about character, then why wouldn't it show up? I'm not saying it's a bad or a good thing what she's writing about him, but it's definitely an informative thing and really interesting. Noreen, you wrote completely hilariously about...
I was a little mean.
That was just awesome. Noreen on Intel, New York Magazine, wrote a series of blog posts about Obama, like, what phase in a girl's life she's in when she is attracted to this kind of dude.
We should read a little bit of one of his letters. So at one point, he was in a long-distance relationship with a woman who was in California. And, you know, she was interested in postmodern deconstruction of literature. And she was on a literature journal. You know, I was like an English major girl in college. Like, you know, I developed crushes on guys, like, because they said the right thing about Hegel. So I, you know, this comes from a place of knowing. This is a love letter. It was framed as a love letter. He says, "I will hazard these statements. Eliot contains the same ecstatic vision which runs from Munzer to Yeats. However, he retains a grounding in the social reality / order of his time. Facing what he perceives as a choice between ecstatic chaos and lifeless mechanistic order, he accedes to maintaining a separation of asexual purity and brutal sexual reality." And it just goes on and on. And so I sort of made a...
Why are we laughing? It's like...
It sounds like his coursework, right? Which one of our commenters pointed out on my initial post. So then I called up some professors who teach The Wasteland at Columbia and asked them to grade it as,
I love that.
As a paper. And it was funny. The male professor I asked was fairly harsh on it, you know. But then he said, you know, points to this guy for using this to try to pick up women. And the female professor was totally swayed. She was like, he really connected with the source material. And they both emailed me afterwards, and I guess they're pals. And they were like, normally the guy is the good cop and the woman is the bad cop. And something about Obama's writing had had charmed her out of that. So so that's, you know, that's an advertisement for it, maybe. I found some of the other details just hilarious. Like, she remembered how on Sundays Obama would lounge around drinking coffee and solving the New York Times crossword puzzle, bare-chested, wearing a white and blue sarong. Like, I just, that image is just amazing. Just, I don't
know. Do you not, like, fall in love with him a little bit here?
Totally. And the story of how he met the woman, you know, at some party in the East Village where, you know, she was smoking Camels and drinking Baileys from the bottle. Like, it was just a really, like, sort of familiar scene.
Yeah.
And it's weird to think of this guy who's talking to world leaders and, you know, in a suit all the time, sort of at a grungy East Village apartment, trying to pick up a girl who's drinking from the bottle. Like, it was kind of awesome.
And smoking filterless cigarettes. And also, you know, the whole thing about the Pakistanis, right? I had actually forgotten about his crew of Pakistani friends, you know, because, like, it's like you go through 9/11 and the war on terror, and you forget that, like, all of his college friends was this, like, crew of Pakistanis. He lived kind of a cool life. He was, like, on the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. He was with this white girlfriend, you know. He was having all these, like, intense and maybe ponderous kind of self-analysis and hanging out with this crew of Pakistanis who were going to become businessmen. I mean, he's like a super interesting guy, you know?
I think every woman, like 95% of women, have known a guy like this. Like, really arrogant, uses words that you definitely don't understand and he possibly also doesn't understand. And really, really serious about himself and about, like, the weight of the world and what it all means. It's such a posture of, like, the 19 and 20-year-old guy. Like, and women, too. But his arrogance is like, kind of amazing.
There's why, like, do you find him arrogant? I find him self-absorbed. But why? What? Where for the arrogance?
I have to find this, like, one quote where he's talking to his girlfriend, Alex. And he's like,
oh, yeah. I have to find it.
Is it,
you seem surprised at Elliot's irreconcilable ambivalence?
Yes.
Don't you share this ambivalence yourself? It's so,
Alex,
it's so condescending. And actually, someone made a Tumblr in which they, like, found old arrogant letters that they had written to girls or their friends had written to girls in college, like, full of this kind of stuff, like, very, very similar. And but they borrowed that last sentence on every one, like, and, you know, adapted it. Like, you also seem surprised to have found this much meaning in James Joyce. Don't you share that? You know, it's just like,
wait, but why is that arrogant? Why isn't it
just
like
is,
taking
Hannah.
It just is. It's like he's talking down to her. He's like, don't,
like, he's like mind reading her. He's like, you too cannot escape. You know, the blah 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 blah. I don't know. There's just,
he's like, don't you agree with me, Alex? Don't dare. Just
you,
like,
you must fall sway to the.
But isn't he just taking her seriously? I mean, she's like a freaking critical theorist. She's not, you know, he's not talking to, like, you know, his Genevieve Cook had decided to become a school teacher, so she was engaging intellectually in a completely different way. And, by the way, is an amazing writer. But the other one was going to be an academic, and so he's speaking her. He's speaking her tongue there.
You know, he's trying to prove himself, and he's arrogant in the way that young men are arrogant, where there's, like, that layer of insecurity underneath. Do you know what I mean? Like, where it's like this Janus-faced coin where it's like arrogance on one side and, like, insecurity on the other side. And so they talk up because they're trying to avoid feeling down. And he's, you know, he's trying to prove himself so much through all these references and this language that is so dense and so thick and so kind of, like, unforgiving to the reader.
Right.
He's trying to prove himself so much that I think it does definitely come across as arrogance, but as that kind of youthful arrogance that you can grow out of. Like, you can be excused because you're, you know, you're a Columbia student and you're an English major and you've got ambition and this is just, you're trying to be something that you're not quite yet.
And he's telling her that she doesn't understand her own views.
Yeah.
But so what I found great also in this Vanity Fair article, you know, David Marinus, the guy who wrote the book, did an interview with Obama at the White House. And he says about that era, Obama recalled that he was then, quote, deep inside my own head in a way that in retrospect, I don't think was real healthy. And you can hear he's got the folksy politician thing down, but that also just, that's what happens to people. They sort of get some perspective and
I loved this. Like, I found him so much more relatable after reading this. Like, he's
absolutely
like guys I know. You know, it's definitely good that this didn't come out before the 2008 election because all those charges of arugula elitism, like, would have rung way too true if people had read this stuff. But
photoshops of sarongs everywhere.
While he's solving the crossword puzzle.
I was kind of heartbroken by that I love you thank you moment. Where
she, oh, yeah, that because, was so terrible.
You know, because here they had created, only after reading her journals, because her journals were so deep, they really spoke to an incredible, deep and intimate conversation between these two people, right? He calls it this warm little world that they created. So I understand that maybe it was this warm little world, and somewhere underneath he understood that this world kind of couldn't be carried out. It becomes clear by the end of the excerpt that what he really needs to marry a black woman, and he's not going to stay with this white woman.
And she keeps saying that. She keeps describing a woman who sounds a lot like Michelle Obama.
But what do you say when someone says they love you and you don't?
You're not there yet.
Yeah, what do you say?
Of course you do.
This is the source material for like so many sitcom moments, you know? Like,
right. I love you. Right. So he says thank you, which could seem a little bit pompous, but if he said it the right way, it's possibly better than not saying anything at all.
Right.
Ditto.
The last thing I will say, maybe the reason I didn't completely tune into the arrogance is because I was so moved by a president who had such a period, you know, because that's really such a standard part of the political narrative as imported from, you know, evangelical testimonies. Like, there's a way in which you tell your life story that you had some moment of struggle, but not such struggle, right? You're allowed to have like a little bit of struggle, like you drank a little bit or you smoked a little bit of pot, and then you came out this, you know, strong character who was fit to be president. But he had a kind of genuine, deep, wrenching kind of self-struggle, which wasn't unpleasant to look at. You know, it didn't involve being reckless or doing dumb things. It involved a kind of deep sort of self-examination and analysis by someone who had a pretty confusing legacy he had to sort through. And then he comes out the other side, you know, this person who's essentially intact, like still, you know, warm but cool, still kind of an observer, you know, still kind of an acceptor of different cultures, but fit to be president. So I thought that was pretty cool.
And for as much as I was making fun of his, you know, undergraduate writing, there were a few moments where he had, you know, just beautifully expressed. He wrote at one point, "Caught without a class, a structure, or tradition to support me, in a sense, the choice to take a different path is made for me. The only way to assuage my feelings of isolation are to absorb all the traditions and classes, make them mine, me theirs." And that, you know, that could have come straight out of his 2008 campaign or his, you know, his book he wrote when he was sort of more mature writer. I think that thought was sort of the most revealing thought that he had during that period.
And I was so delighted to be reminded of that Obama, like the Obama we were so startled by when the campaign started and we read his books and you're like, oh my God, this person is a serious candidate for president. He's such a great writer. He's so interesting, self-reflective. And then we've kind of forgotten that over the years and all the kind of political chatter. And then now with this excerpt, we're reminded of that person again, which I was very grateful for. Okay, before we move on to our third topic, we have another sponsor. Longtime listeners of the XX podcast will be familiar with Audible.com, one of the internet's greatest providers of spoken entertainment and also a supporter of all of the Slate podcasts. You can choose from 100,000 audiobooks and listen to them on practically any device. Anyone who's heard me talk about this before knows that I am a huge, huge Audible fan. It has been life-changing in my life. Just on the drive to New York, we were listening to several Audible books for our children. We download books from Audible all the time, and they're offering a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at the URL audiblepodcast.com/XX. So in this case, it's not double X you write out, but the words XX. And your membership includes a free subscription to either the Times or the Wall Street Journal audio segments. The book I'm going to recommend this week, and this has to do with our previous conversation, in a question and answer session about this excerpt in Vanity Fair, David Marinus said something so interesting. The interviewer asked him what was the difference about in writing about Clinton, because David Marinus's biography of Clinton is also quite famous, about Clinton and Obama. And he said the difference between the two of them is they both came from kind of fractured backgrounds, and they were always trying to make up for those fractured backgrounds, but they came out of the struggle in completely opposite ways. That Clinton came out of it very needy and kind of always needing the affirmation of people at every second, and Obama came out of it sort of an observer. He calls him, like, he came out of it with the sensibility of a writer-observer, that he's always kind of one step removed from the things that are happening, and he's always putting them together. And so when I read that Q&A, I went back and listened to Dreams from My Father, which is narrated by Obama himself. He reads the book. And again, it's just amazing. Like, there's a big difference between what I imagine the Marinus book will be like, because it's historically accurate, and Dreams from My Father, we now understand, is not really historically accurate. It has composite girlfriends, and he kind of confuses things that he did in New York and things that he did in Chicago to kind of create a coherent narrative about himself. But it's just super interesting to go back and remember that president that we fell in love with low those years ago. And for me, it was partly because he was such a great writer and talker. Okay, let's move on to our final topic. There was an incredibly disturbing story in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday, much talked about, which was titled, Can You Call Your 9-Year-Old a Psychopath? And it essentially profiled a family and also a series of children who have been classified as callous/unemotional. The idea is that they essentially behave like little psychopaths. It's beyond just bad behavior or tantrum, but that they display a kind of callous indifference to moral behavior and to other people's emotions and are thus extremely hard to discipline because, as this story describes, the way you discipline most children is that if they hit their sister and then you yell at them and their sister starts crying, they feel kind of bad and they carry that bad feeling with them, and that prevents them from doing it the next time. But with this set of children, this article was suggesting, and these set of psychologists were suggesting, these kids don't have that feedback loop. They don't really feel bad. And so they end up being unbelievably manipulative for little kids. Reading it again just gave me chills, you know?
Yeah.
Libby, what were you thinking about when you read the story?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting that the writer Jennifer Kahn brings out is that there's this debate within the psychiatric community about to what extent you should actually be labeling these kids as psychopaths or, you know, as pre-psychopathic. Because if there's no real way to treat it at the moment, and there's no real way to kind of get these kids to a state of normal behavior, are you just kind of putting them into this really terrible box that isolates them and isolates their families from support and then just kind of makes people really freaked out. And there's also this difficulty with the extent to which you can actually predict whether a kid who has these psychopathic or callous, unemotional tendencies as a child will actually go and become, say, a psychopath in adult life. And if so, what kind of form that psychopathy will take? I mean, it's interesting to me, but, you know, the same day that this piece came out, there was another piece in one of the Sunday sections of the New York Times. It was an op-ed talking about how a significant number of people who work on Wall Street are found to have some form of psychopathy.
Oh, yeah, that was and it was like 10 to 15%.
10%, yeah. I think. And, you know, in the piece that we're talking about, the magazine piece, she mentions that there seems to be a correlation between psychopathy and wealth, which I'd actually heard before when I'd interviewed someone about psychopathy for a story once. So how do you know whether you're going to be the kind of psychopath that's going to grow up to like make a lot of money and just be kind of like, you know, the kind of person that your wife thinks is a little weird? Or are you going to be a psychopath that's like killing people? And like in the magazine piece, she interviews, I guess he's a psychologist, actually describes one boy who, quote, used a knife to cut off the tail of the family cat bit by bit over a period of weeks. The boy was proud of the serial amputations, which his parents failed to notice. When we talked about it, he was very straightforward, Frick recalls. He said, I want to be a scientist, and I was experimenting. I wanted to see how the cat react. Like, it's just, it makes you, like, absolutely sick to your stomach. The kid that's followed by Jennifer Kahn, who we know by one name, Michael, you know, he doesn't amputate a cat's tail, but he is incredibly chilling in his behavior. He talks about hating his brother. He punches holes in the walls. He pulls out his own hair. He cuts up his pants. You know, he destroys the toilet seat by banging it over and over. And there's this scene.
But it's premeditated.
It's all premeditated. And he can turn it on and off like a switch. And there's this scene where he's like yelling at his mother. And she says to him, you know, I thought we kind of rehearsed all this yesterday. And we did some brainstorming so this wouldn't happen. And he's screaming and crying. And he stops all of a sudden. And he looks at her and he says, well, you didn't think that through very clearly then, did you? And you're just kind of like, holy shit.
I know. It was so horror movie. I mean, it's the sort of screaming and tantruming.
So
that's fine, right? Like that's you know.
That's normal. Right.
Well, I mean, there's some kids who are off the scale on the impulsivity and are really hard to handle. It was more just that lack of impulsivity. Mm-hmm. The fact that these, you know, I mean, the chilling example, which is even really hard to talk about, is apparently a famous one in these circles, which is someone who drowned a toddler and pulled up his chair to watch the toddler drown.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, in the swimming pool.
Yeah, in the swimming pool. So that's the extreme behavior. But short of the extreme behavior, I think the moral question that was hinted at in this story, but not entirely resolved, was on the one hand, the writer says that these things are genetic or likely to be genetic. Mm-hmm. And there is some indication that the father of this kid she writes about was also somewhat this way in childhood. She doesn't get too much into that, but that had some of these tendencies in childhood and that it is linked to certain deficiencies in the brain, you know, so that these are things that you can control. And then sort of the article winds up in a spot that says, you know, but we have to do our best to keep them from becoming serial killers. So there's kind of, there really is this moral question unanswered of, does it do any good to label these kids as right. psychopaths? Because essentially you're turning off any sympathy that anyone might have for them. And this was a question that Amanda Marcotte raised in a blog post she did for Double X, where she said, you know, is it like autism? You know, is it one of these, should we have basically cultivate more sympathy for someone who's labeled as a psychopath? And people were furious about that blog post. There is something about psychopath that we associate so strongly with evil that it's actually really tricky when you do that to a child. And there was a wonderful NPR story done by a friend of mine, Elise Spiegel, recently about the psychopath test. There's a standard test that's used to measure whether somebody is a psychopath, and it's given to criminals. And criminals who score high, no matter what they do in prison, basically will never get parole. And she profiles one or two people who, you know, it seems by every other standard should get parole, but because they've measured high on this particular test will never get parole because any of their good actions are labeled as manipulations, you know. And there is, to me as a parent, like the horrifying scenes in this story have to do with the mother's confusing reaction to her own child. So anytime he behaves well or gives her hugs or kisses, she is always doubting whether that's a true note of affection or manipulation. And that's like a horrible position yeah. to be in as a mother.
You know, she seems to be doing the best that she can with like an incredibly terrible hand that she's been dealt. But I guess my question is, so Libby brought up that plenty of psychopaths are really successful people, whether on Wall Street or elsewhere. And as you said, the dad, he was pretty vague on how he got over it, but somewhere in his teens, this sort of changed for him. And presumably the underlying brain chemistry didn't change, but he was able to channel it into something else. And so, you know, maybe just the fact that this has been raised, people are going to start trying to figure out ways that it, you know, can be channeled. Like even within this, it seems like there is a nature versus nurture thing going on right. here. But the thing I can't help thinking about is the famous Stanford marshmallow experiment where the kids who, you know, wait for their marshmallow are shown to be more successful. And I just keep picturing like a child like waiting for the marshmallow and then like murdering it or something, you know, and like he grows up to be successful.
You know, I think to some extent the kind of dilemma or the conflict in this magazine piece is kind of a red herring, or it's a false conflict, because I really don't think that there is a very strong argument to be made for not labeling, studying, and trying to help these kids. And in order to help them, you do have to label them. I mean, that's
what
just...
What about yeah. the idea that, you know, if you tell a kid he's a psychopath, he will, like, look up what psychopath means and see what psychopaths do and, you know? What about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that you could, like, make a kid who wasn't already inclined to cut off the tail of a cat, like, cut off the tail of a cat. But I do think that, you know, potentially what the kid could get out of therapy is so significant that it would be a small price to pay to tell them that, you know, they're struggling with some issues known as, you know, callous, unemotional, whatever, whatever. I think to me, the most deeply troubling part of the magazine essay, of the magazine piece, comes when the writer asks the psychopath's mother or the pre-psychopath's mother if he's, you know, basically worried if this kid, Michael, this 9-year-old, is going to take, his behavior is going to take a psychological toll on his two younger brothers. And she looks, quote, surprised by the idea. You know, this I found incredibly troubling. This is a kid who is like saying that he hates his brother. He's saying, I'm going to come after you. And you know what happens when you provoke me. You know, and I think in a situation like this, you know, the parents are in many ways the least vulnerable figures. I have a great deal more sympathy for the little brothers who, you know, they have to live with this kid, and maybe treating him isn't something that has to go on in the home, but rather outside the home to protect the two younger children. That seems to be the real damage that's going to happen in that house.
Don't you think that had to have been a coping mechanism on her part? You know, she just has to be like, I have two who are fine. I have two who are fine. And right. just repeat that to herself that, you know, they sort of have this underlying baseline okayness. And
yeah,
you know,
I think that that's a willful blindness that winds up biting you in the butt.
Probably. It just, you know, no, it yeah. she probably just keeps wanting to believe that she can have them because she presumably loves him in spite of,
oh,
like,
sure,
you know,
and yeah, it's awful. It's an awful situation to be in.
Yeah, I've recently, I can't talk about it, but I've seen a situation like this recently of sort of one sibling turn against another in a kind of a demented way. And it's like, I never wish that on any mother. Yeah. I mean, it's just a horrible situation. The last thing I want to say about this is that I agree about treatment and doing anything you can for these children, obviously. But that school of psychopaths seemed like not such a good idea to me. It was like, they were just like perfecting. It felt to me exactly what people say happens to adults in prison. That when you, you know, you put people in prison and it kind of concentrates.
This is how you make a shift.
Exactly. It was totally like that. It was like, oh, that's how the girl does it. I'm going to take in some of those methods.
Yeah, it was bad. It was like juvie hall or something, you know, and they were just like learning from each other.
So what do you do?
In the therapy they talked about at the end, which is teaching people to mimic emotions.
Mimic empathy
sounds weird to people. It's exactly what they do with autistic children, and it's or even like slightly autistic children, and it's completely standard and might sound weird to people, but you know, it works. And it's been tested for a while and has very specific methods and, you know, things that are completely obvious to you and I are not obvious to such children. Like when you do this, you know, the person's reaction will be this, and then you will feel like this. And like all the things that we would know completely easily is not obvious to many, many, many children who are.
That struck me as problematic too. And I think she talks about this a little bit because they are particularly good at manipulating emotions once they understand the way that people are going to react. Like there's another scene that I found chilling where the dad is taking him away to bed and he screams at his dad, like, no, daddy, I have a greater bond with you than
it's
I do with
so
mom.
Weird.
And that is, you know, like, and so he knows that people are susceptible to like rivalries and like.
Yeah, the weird thing is that he'll be better at that. Like, that's kind of a crude form of manipulation. Any parent could see through that. But
if greater bond.
As he gets better and better at it, it's going to be more and more scary. OK, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
It's a book I'd been meaning to read for a long time. It's been out for about a year. It's Blood, Bones, and Butter by Gabrielle Hamilton, who is a chef in New York. And she's just an amazing writer. She, it turns out, you figure out halfway through the book, actually wanted to be a writer. And you know, cooking was sort of this accidental thing that just happened to her. And she went to an MFA program before opening her restaurant, Prune, which is well received. And yeah, she's just a wonderful stylist. And she has sort of, you know, an eventful life that she tells well. So Blood, Bones,
you know what
Butter.
I was wondering about that book, which I've meant to read for a long time. Does it have that macho, you know, Anthony Bourdain? Like a lot of these chef books, they turned me off after a while. I read lots of them in the early years, but they were so like, fuck every third word. And, you know, they were so macho that I was hoping
it's
that
not,
she would be an antidote to that.
Well, the beginning of the book is actually my favorite part. Usually I hate when people like meditate on their childhood, but her writing in that section is so beautiful. And when she does open the restaurant, there is a certain amount of macho posture. Like she was quite successful and she doesn't really hide that fact, which I think is sort of great. But it does fall into the trope of like, oh, and like everyone in kitchens does cocaine and like we have tattoos and we're super badass. But I do think she's a lot more self-conscious. She's not playing that up as much as Anthony Bourdain is. In the way that good food has like an unexpected note, like her sentences have all of a sudden an unexpected note. It's just very evocative in the way that all good food writing is because, you know, taste and smell and all those kinds of things lend themselves to good writing. You do it right.
That sounds great. I'm going to go second. I have been looking for another story. I'm writing for The Atlantic at lots and lots of children's apps and subjecting my son to lots of experiments and everything, which I'll explain when the story actually comes out. But one app that I've discovered, which I really love, is called Noodle Words. And it's in this vein of trying to come up with sort of creative, cool things for extremely young children to do. And this is a kind of, you know, learn to read app, but it's so funny and so creative and has these two great characters and was created by this guy who actually doesn't have children, but is one of these, you know, people who sort of taps into a childlike sensibility really, really well. So it's definitely my favorite of the ones I've discovered recently. Libby, what's your recommendation?
This comes from Rookie Magazine, which is my newest guilty pleasure, which is Tavi Gevinson's wonderful online
magazine. I'm so glad you've been reading that. I've been wondering what's going on with Rookie.
So good.
Oh, really?
So,
oh, I'm so glad
so
to
good.
Hear it.
She had one whole section that was just about famous women's first times having sex, and like they wrote about it so intimately. But anyway, every like month or so, they have in a video segment called Ask a Grown Man. It's gotten a little bit of viral attention. Like I saw it on Facebook and then it got picked up by the Esquire newsletter and probably a lot of people have seen it by now, but they asked John Hamm to do the last one. And so these teenage girls who are like 15 write in with questions and John Hamm sits in front of his computer and his webcam and he like answers them. And he is wearing, you know, the most undone Draper Lake outfit. I think he's like an old Cardinals t-shirt. And Pee Wee Girls are asking him things like, you know, dear grown man, I want to do more stuff than my boyfriend wants to do. He says we should take it slow, but I'd like to really do more stuff. What should I do? And John Hamm's like, well, keep it slow, girl, or whatever. It's brilliant. It's like he's funny and he's wry and he's understated. And like you completely just like fall in love with him like 1,000 times. So, yeah,
I watched that.
Ask a grown man.
I had no idea that was coming from Rookie. I didn't make that connection. And the thing I was just thinking about John Hamm and like how hard he's trying to counter the Don Draper personality lately.
Yes.
Like he's always showing up in these kind of improbable comedic.
And I don't know if they've ever done Mark Ruffalo, but if anyone from Rookie magazine is listening to this and you ever want to do it, Ask a Grown Man, I would definitely nominate him. I think he'd be really good.
The Paul Rudd one was also amazing.
Oh,
did
yes.
You see that one?
Yes.
That was really funny. I think they're like catering to a certain kind of woman with these, but it's fine by me.
It's a very smart, mature teenager.
Yeah.
And those of us who are no longer teenagers.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me. It's been a total pleasure. Thank you to Abdullah Rufus for engineering this podcast. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who is the executive producer of all the podcasts. As always, please log on to our XX Facebook page and tell us what you would like us to talk about. And another thing we'd like to ask you, if you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes, you just search Slate XX in the iTunes store. And please, when you're there, leave a comment and we will be sure to read it. It's been great, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.